Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Yeah, that's a little bit different music. That's because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. We get all kinds of weird questions. As a matter of fact, Jimmy has developed a reputation, such a reputation for weird questions that often when another apologist is on and we get a weird question, their first reaction is, oh, that's a Jimmy Akin question. Because Jimmy's willing to take whatever question you've got, take it seriously, and give you the best answer that he can come up with. So people have taken him up on that and sent all kinds of weird questions. And I have lost my place. Who are we going to next? Is it Mike?
Question 29.
Yeah, okay. I'm back to where we were. All right, this one comes from Mike. I've heard some folks claim that hell is where God isn't present. But isn't that impossible if God is omnipresent?
Yeah, so this question comes up periodically, and it's based on two concepts. The first concept is that hell is the absence of God, and I have trouble saying that's literally true. Mm-hmm. Because of God's omnipresence. But God's omnipresence itself is a concept that has to be understood with some finesse, because it's not like God has a body that fills physical space. So even talking about God being omnipresent God isn't present in a place the way you or I are present in a place. You know, you or I are present in a place if that's where our body is located. But God doesn't have a body apart from the incarnation. And so what do we mean when we talk about God's presence somewhere? Well, according to the medieval theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas, the same thing is actually true not just of God, but of angels, because angels also don't have bodies, and neither do humans when they are in a discarnate state, you know, after they're dead. Ghosts, according to Aquinas, don't have a physical location either, because they don't have a spirit body. Now, I think you might be able to question this idea in terms of human spirits. They may not, you know, and I think you could question it in terms of angels, but just hypothetically, I'm not seriously proposing that they have spirit bodies. I think hypothetically one could wonder about that. Is there a possibility that they might have something that has physical location, even if it's not a physical body? But the people like Aquinas assumed they didn't. And so they actually answered this question in principle. So Aquinas would say, how can an angel or human spirit be present somewhere without a physical body? And what Aquinas concluded was, well, they have an effect in different places. So like if an angel is, let's say, stirring up some water somewhere, like at a healing pool in Bethesda, mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. This is based on some variant readings in the Gospel of John, where there's this healing pool in Jerusalem, and according to some manuscripts, there was an angel that would come down and stir up the waters, and then whoever got in the pool first would get healed. And there is a lame guy there. I don't mean he was lame in the modern sense. I mean, he physically could not walk, and he couldn't get into the pool in time. So he was always getting left out on the healing. And so let's suppose you've got an angel stirring up the waters. Well, okay, that angel is having an effect on this location. And so Aquinas would say that angels can have an effect or can be spoken of as being present wherever they're having an effect. So you could say the angel is here at the Pool of Bethesda because it's affected the Pool of Bethesda. Even though technically the angel does not have a spatial location at all, we can still analogically speak of it as having a location because of where it's affected. So if we take that principle and we apply it to God, what do we get? Well, God is the creator of the world, and the world would not exist if God hadn't created it, and the world would not continue to exist if God didn't continue to create it and maintain it in existence. This is something John Paul II, for example, spoke about how the preservation of the universe is a form of continuous creation on God's part. He has to keep creating the space and time to maintain the universe in existence. And so God affects all physical locations, and therefore you can speak of God analogically the way you speak of an angel being present where it's having an effect. You can speak of God as being present everywhere because he's having an effect everywhere. He's maintaining everything in existence. And so given that, we, even though God doesn't have a physical body and is not present the way we are present, he nevertheless can be spoken of as being omnipresent because he has an effect everywhere on everything that, that exists. So given that, if someone is in hell, they continue to exist. You know, and so God is continuing to have an effect on them. And so in this sense, God is present where this person is present. And that means this idea that hell is where God is not has to be understood in some other sense. Now, there is a basis for people saying like hell is the absence of God, because there are these passages in the New Testament where Jesus, for example, depicts hell as like outer darkness, you know, in, like in the parable of the wedding garments, where the king throws a banquet for his son and, you know, a bunch of people don't come. And so he invites a lot of other people in. But when the king in the parable, is who represents God, is going around, he finds this guy who is not properly attired for a wedding. So he's disrespecting the host by showing up and not wearing a proper wedding garment. So he's being a jerk. He's kind of snubbing his nose in the host's face. And so the king orders that this guy be taken out and thrust into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so this parable depicts hell as a state of separation from God. And the question, and that's a valid, you know, way of looking at things. So the question is, given that God is analogically omnipresent everywhere because he has an effect everywhere, including for the damned person that continues to exist, what kind of separation are we talking about here? And I think the answer is spiritual separation. Hell is the spiritual absence of God, where one has, by one's will, turned away from God and rejected him on a spiritual level. You can't reject him on an ontological level because he keeps you in existence. So you always have an ontology is the study of existence. And so you can't reject God on an ontological level. You always have an ontological connection with God. But you can still do the, I'm not wearing a wedding garment for you, God. I'm going to thumb my nose at you. And you can create a spiritual barrier between you and God. And so I think that's the sense in which we need to understand hell as the absence of God. It's not the ontological absence of God. It's the spiritual absence of God.
Mike, thank you. Wonderful question to start are the second hour with Jimmy. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. It does, in fact, bring us to the break. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions for Jimmy right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The EWTN On Demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV, your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. That music means Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour, and lots of weird questions to come. This one comes from Jason. Did Jesus's guardian angel have the easiest job?
Well, maybe. You know, if a guardian angel's job is to guard us from temptation and so forth, well, Jesus didn't have any disordered desires. And so if, in that respect, Jesus's guardian angel would have had the easiest job. But that may not be the only thing that Jesus' guardian angel was tasked with. His guardian angel may have had other duties that would have made his job harder, like protecting Jesus from constant demonic attack. So maybe Jesus's guardian angel had the hardest job of all. You know, he had to fend off all the demons that wanted to subvert Jesus's plans. And so so it's possible he could have had a much harder job than most guardian angels. Also, another task he may have had was keeping Jesus hidden. Because there is, you know, people have noticed, okay, so what's up with the temptation or testing in the wilderness? In Greek, temptation and testing are the same thing, where the devil comes and tries to tempt Jesus. I mean, doesn't he know that as the all-holy Son of God, Jesus is not going to sin, so testing him is pointless or trying to tempt him is pointless? Well, maybe he did know that. And my best interpretation of why the devil might do that is he did know that the all-holy Son of God is not going to give in to temptation. And so what he was doing by trying to subject Jesus to temptation was trying to find out, is this really the Son of God or not? And there is this theme in early Christian literature of Jesus, especially in his early life, being hidden in some way from the forces of darkness. I was talking about this recently. This is a very prominent theme, for example. Now, this book is not in the Bible, but there is an early Christian apocalypse written about the year 67. And there's a fairly narrow range of when this book was written. It was after the death of Peter, which happened in 65 or 66, but before the suicide of Nero, which happened in mid-68. So it looks like this book was written about AD 67, plus or minus 12 months. And it's called The Ascension of Isaiah. And the hiddenness of Jesus's birth and early life is a very prominent theme in The Ascension of Isaiah. At one point in the narrative, Isaiah has been caught up to seventh heaven, and he witnesses the descent of Jesus through the seven heavens and then through the firmament, where the atmosphere, which is where the demons are, to be born as a child. And the Son of God puts on disguises as he's descending. He makes himself look like the angels that live in these different heavens on his way down, so they don't recognize it's the Son of God. And then when he gets into the atmosphere, the firmament, he's disguised there too. and they think, oh, he's just a demon or something. And then he gets born. And then he ends up getting crucified and then rising from the dead. And he throws open his identity for everybody to see. And he reascends through the firmament and through the seven heavens to get back up to where he started. And all of the demons and all of the angels are like, wait, how did he get down below us? We didn't see him come down. And so, even though this is not canonical, it is this theme of divine hiddenness, or Christocentric hiddenness, I should say, is there in early Christian literature. And so it's possible that even before his adult ministry, Jesus's guardian angel had been tasked with keeping him hidden so that the devil, for example, would not know exactly who is the Son of God. Is it this Jesus guy or somebody else? That's one possible task. And then once Jesus's identity is thrown open, which happened during his earthly ministry, because the demons start recognizing him after the devil has tested him, then he may have been subject to various demonic attacks. You know, if you think about the temptation in the wilderness or the testing in the wilderness, that was a form of demonic attack. And he passed that. But that didn't mean the demons all stopped. So, you know, in terms of, did Jesus's guardian angel have the easiest job? Well, maybe in one respect, he didn't have to really protect him against temptation, but he may have had to protect him against other things like being discovered or being attacked by demons.
What a great question. Thank you very much, Jason, for that. This one comes from the JMLou11. I have a question on resurrection. And if resurrection requires that our bodies be the same as our earthly bodies. Recently, I finished a fictional story, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Steel Ball Run, where the characters receive powers from having some interaction with the body of Christ. The story takes place on an alternate earth, though the story of Christ is mostly the same, except for the fact that he resurrected, but that his corpse remains. This is very likely that because the author is Japanese, that he does not know the specifics of Christian theology. This made me wonder if the resurrection of the body requires the same earthly body that died, or could God possibly create a new body for us, our heavenly bodies?
Okay, so what the church teaches is that our body in the resurrection is the same as the body we had in this life, but it doesn't teach that all the same matter is involved. And this is something that has been discussed actually for centuries, going back into the Middle Ages. Theologians would talk about, well, so what would happen if someone, if a cannibal ate you? So the matter that's in your body later became the matter that's in the cannibal's body. And they would talk about these questions. So, you know, people, when they ask similar questions today, oh, what if a cannibal ate you? What would happen in the resurrection? Ha, ha, ha. So, okay, dude, we've been here for hundreds of years. We've thought about that. And so there was a recognition that the matter in your body changes over time. Now, back then, they didn't have the modern atomic theory of matter. The idea had been proposed. It had been proposed by some ancient Greek philosophers, for example, named Leucippus and Democritus, but it was always a minority view. The majority view was based on Aristotelian science, which held that there is this stuff called not atoms, but this infinitely divisible stuff called matter that takes on different forms, that makes it different kinds of matter. But it was recognized that it was sometimes called the stuff down at the bottom underneath all the forms is sometimes called prime matter. And so it was recognized that the prime matter in your body changes over time. You know, that's obvious just by watching a baby grow. Babies are not 150 pounds, but they may be 150 pounds by the time they grow up. So it was recognized as the baby eats and grows, the baby acquires more matter in its body. It was also recognized that we also get rid of some of the matter that enters our bodies. So there, and today, after the discovery of, or confirmation of the atomic theory of matter, we have an even more precise understanding about how much matter changes over. If you think about the amount of food that you eat in a lifetime, and this may be more for some of us than others, I call it.
Oh, come on.
But if I'm just, it was there. Sorry.
It was there. Yeah.
So if you think about the amount of food you eat in a lifetime compared to your average body weight, you know, the amount of food you eat in a lifetime is enormous compared to how much we individually weigh. And so obviously there's a lot of material turnover. And, you know, every few years, most of all the cells of our bodies, except like in our bones, they change over and stuff. So there's been a recognition that our bodies can be the same. Like, I have the same body now I did when I was an infant, but basically all of the matter in my body has changed since I was an infant. So we can have the same body, even if it doesn't involve the same matter. Well, this is something that has recently been commented upon both by the International Theological Commission, which is an advisory body that's run by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. And it's even more recently than that been commented on by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith itself. So there's a recognition that even though we'll have the same body, it may not involve the same matter. That's something we have to leave up to God. What I would say in Jesus's case is that even though it's hypothetically possible that God could have in his resurrection created the same body, I find it very hard to imagine that none of the same matter was involved. So and this also goes back to some documents that have been written by the International Theological Commission. Any interpretation of the resurrection of Jesus that leaves his body in the tomb, like in this story that is being described, is an inadequate understanding. We may not have a promise that all the same matter is going to be in our resurrection body that's in our physical body at the end of its life, but leaving Jesus's corpse in his tomb is not an adequate understanding of the resurrection. And I would say the same thing for this story. But in terms of the question, could God possibly create a new body for us that didn't involve the matter in our earthly bodies? Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for the question, JM. On we go. This one comes from Lara-GJ1DU. I don't know if that has any particular meaning, but there it is. Lara wants to know, my daughter wants to know, she says, what would happen if you dropped a skyscraper-sized piece of tungsten onto a nuclear armory where the bombs are stored? Would all the bombs go off? How big a fallout would it be? And would it be a deterrent for nuclear weapons?
Okay. Actually, your daughter may have a promising future in munitions design, because she's talking about in dropping a skyscraper piece of tungsten on a nuclear armory. She's actually describing a weapon system that has been proposed. This weapon system is sometimes it's what's known as a mass driver. So you have this like mass of tungsten and you drive it from orbit into a particular location on Earth to destroy what's at that target. And it's often proposed that you drop rods of tungsten onto these sites. And this version of the mass driver is nicknamed Rods from God, because you're dropping rods of tungsten out of the heavens. So let's suppose you had a skyscraper-sized one and you dropped it on a nuclear armory. What would happen? Well, it depends on what kind of bombs are stored in the armory. Are they... because their nuclear bombs work different ways. What happens in a nuclear bomb is you have to bring a certain amount of radioactive material together to create a chain reaction. And that amount of matter is what's known as the critical mass. So you have to get, let's say, enough uranium-235 together in one place to create a chain reaction that causes it to go critical in a way that will then cause it to explode, producing the nuclear explosion. So there is a fairly simple form of bomb known as the gun model, where what you have is you have half of the material you need for critical mass at one end of the device and half of the material you need for critical mass at the other end of the device. And you basically shoot one of those masses, like shooting a bullet out of a gun, towards the other. It brings the two masses together really fast. It goes critical and it explodes. Gun model bombs are like the one that was dropped on Hiroshima, the so-called little man or little boy bomb. And they work so simply that they didn't even bother testing this one. They'd done the calculations. They knew this one was going to work. But gun model bombs tend to have smaller payloads. Now, if you have a nuclear armory that's full of gun model bombs and you drop a tungsten rod on the nuclear armory, the result in damage could force some of the critical mass components together and cause nuclear explosions. So if there are gun model bombs in there, you might get some nuclear explosions when you drop the tungsten rod. On the other hand, there's another kind of nuclear bomb that works differently. And I'm guessing we're about to have the music come up on us.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you about the other kind of nuclear bomb and what would happen if you dropped a rod from God on it on the other side of the break.
All right. Let's just not give the computers control over this. We cannot let Skynet get wind of this. But thank you very much, Laura, and your daughter for the question. We'll continue with Jimmy's answer right after this. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Well, welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're in the midst of a bunch of weird questions for Jimmy Akin. And this one comes from Laura and her daughter. Her daughter had the idea of dropping skyscraper-sized pieces of tungsten onto nuclear armories, and a series of questions. Would the bombs go off? How big would the fallout be? And would this be a deterrent for nuclear weapons? Jimmy, you were in the midst of an answer.
Yeah, so we're working on the first question here of what would happen with the bombs. And I'd mentioned that if you have a gun model bomb, like the little boy bomb that was dropped on Japan in World War II, then you basically have two masses of radioactive material, like U-235. And if they come into contact with each other, then they go critical and blow up. Okay, so if you drop a tungsten rod on an armory that's filled with that kind of bomb, some of the individual mass components might get jostled together and go critical, and you could have nuclear explosions. But there's another kind of bomb that is more powerful. And the reason that it's more powerful is there's a limit. If you're using a gun model bomb, there's a limit to how big you can make the components. Like in uranium, I want to say that critical mass is something like 11 pounds of isotope 235. I may have that wrong, but that's my memory. So let's assume that critical mass of uranium 235 is 11 pounds. That means you could have one five and a half pound chunk and another 5.5 pound chunk at the ends of a gun model bomb, and then you slam them together and it goes critical and we get an uncontrolled reaction which leads to an explosion. Okay, fine. You got your explosion, but you can't really make it much bigger because you can't make the components much bigger. I mean, you've got to keep your components. If 11 pounds is the critical mass, you've got to keep the components under 11 pounds. And so, because otherwise they'll go critical before you want them to. So there's a limit to how much mass you can put into this kind of a bomb. So how can we circumvent that? Well, we can use a different type of bomb that distributes the radioactive material and then brings it all together really quickly. So since it's more distributed, you can pile on more material. The question then is, how do you get it all together really fast to cause that precious explosion? Well, the answer is you use implosion. So what you do is you take the radioactive material and you put it inside of, you may have a primer at the center, but you put it inside of a sphere and you set the sphere to implode, which is the reverse of explode. And so you place a whole bunch of charges around the outside of the sphere that are explosive charges. And when you blow those explosive charges, then it will cause all that force will be directed towards the center of the sphere. It'll push together all of the radioactive material really fast, and you'll get a much bigger nuclear explosion. And so this is the type of bomb, this implosion type bomb was what was used. It was the Fat Man bomb that was also dropped on Japan. And this one, unlike the gun model bomb, this one they had to test because implosion bombs are really tricky. It's not as simple as just slamming two pieces of radioactive material together. Instead, you've got to shape the explosion very carefully so that it implodes evenly. If it doesn't implode evenly, then some of it's going to vent off and through an imperfection in the design, and you're not going to get your precious explosion. So you need to be very careful with how you cause the implosion to happen. And that means that conceptually, implosion-style bombs are fragile. They have to be very carefully designed, or they won't blow up. And so what would then happen if you dropped a tungsten skyscraper on a nuclear armory filled with implosion bombs, is you just smash the bombs. But these bombs are not as simple as slamming two pieces. Wreck the bombs, but you would not get any explosions. So that leads us, and hydrogen bombs and so forth, they're just fancy explosion bombs, or fancy implosion bombs. So what happens with the next question? How big a fallout would you get in dropping a tungsten rod on this? Well, like I said, it depends on what bombs are in there. If you drop a rod on gun model bombs, you may get some explosions that will generate moderate amounts of radioactive fallout because these are moderate sized explosions. They can't be very big. So you could get significant fallout that way. On the other hand, if you drop a rod on a nuclear armory that's filled with implosion style bombs, they're not going to detonate. What may happen is you may get a little bit of fallout that's the equivalent of what is ordinarily called a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb is not actually a nuclear weapon. Instead, it's a conventional weapon that explodes and scatters nuclear material. So there's no nuclear explosion here. It's just a regular explosion that happens to be laced with nuclear material, and that's why it's called a dirty bomb. Well, if you dropped a rod on a nuclear weapons armory that had implosion-style bombs in them, there is some radioactive material in them, and by dropping the rod, you're going to cause, you know, a bunch of damage. And so this would be the equivalent of a dirty bomb going off. So there would be no nuclear explosion. You might get a little bit of fallout, but not much, and not compared to a real nuclear explosion. Would it be a good deterrent for nuclear weapons? Well, depends who does it. If aliens came down and did this, it might scare everybody. But if one nation state tried doing it to another nation state, or if a James Bond style supervillain tried, who had an eco conscience or something, tried doing it to some nation state, I would think it would be more likely to produce a violent reaction. And so I think it would be more likely to provoke nuclear war than deter it, because unless you're aliens and can surround the planet with spaceships, there's no way that you're going to be able to drop rods on all of the weapon stockpiles on Earth. And what that means is if someone starts destroying individual weapon stockpiles, but they don't have the credible threat to destroy them all, then it's going to lead to more nuclear instability on the use it or lose it principle. Because if I'm some country and I've got, you know, a bunch of nuclear stockpiles and someone is beginning to take them out, I'm more likely to use the ones I have while I can still use them. So, Laura, I think your daughter has a promising future in weapons design, but I would leave the diplomacy to the diplomats in this case.
Thank you very much for the question. This next one comes from Nebo. Assuming that Nephilim are literally the result of human women somehow mating with fallen angels, what sort of nature would they have? Could they be baptized?
Okay, so anyone who wants to be baptized, the church is pretty much going to baptize them. We're assuming that Nephilim, notice again, this is a question I'm being asked. And the question assumes that Nephilim are literally the result of human women somehow mating with angels. So I'm not advocating that this happens. I'm just answering the question. Okay. So I'll tell you what Thomas Aquinas thought, and then I'll tell you what I think. Aquinas thought that this was possible. He thought that there are situations based on reports he had received where women were impregnated by demons. So demon babies were a real thing for him, or at least a possible thing. And his argument was that his claim was that although demons can, like other angels, can come up with temporary aerial bodies that they can use, to function in the world, kind of like avatars in the movie Avatar, they can't actually create human reproductive cells. And so he said in order to explain these accounts, they'd have to get the reproductive cells from some human. And so what they would do, on Aquinas's view, would be first they would appear to a human as a succubus. A succubus is a female demon that has marital relations with a man. And so the demon would first appear as a succubus, have relations with the man, get the male germ cells, and then take them. Then they'd do a walk on the wild side. They'd flip from being a succubus to an incubus, which is a female demon, or another kind of demon that has relations with a woman. They'd take the male germ cells they got from the man, then they'd have relations in a new form with a woman and impregnate the woman with the cells they got from a human man. And so as a result, the demon baby, even though there was a demon involved in its conception, is going to be purely human. Wow. And so, yeah, so that's Aquinas's view. But Aquinas's view is predicated on two things. The first one is that, and I don't blame Aquinas for this because he didn't know about genetic engineering, but the first thing is it's predicated on the idea that the demon didn't tamper with the genes of the germ cells it got from the man. I would say, hey, we can do gene editing now. Maybe demons can do it too, in which case the person might not be fully human. They might be an extra large human, for example, just like the Nephilim were reported to be. In Aramaic, the word Nephilim means giants. So maybe there could have been some genetic modifications. The other thing is Aquinas is assuming that that demons don't have the telekinetic control of matter at a level needed to produce human germ cells. I'd want to know how he knows that. I don't know what limits demons or other angels have on their telekinetic powers. And if they can manipulate matter to produce aerial bodies for themselves to use, I don't know why they can't manipulate matter to produce human germ cells out of other matter. So I don't know that you have to go the fully human route the way Aquinas does. I think there are other possibilities.
All right. Thank you very much for the question. That qualifies as weird enough, and we appreciate it, Nebo. I think I better take a quick break, and then we'll come back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
This is Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. I know for a fact that we have brothers and sisters who are not Catholic, who are not even believers in Jesus, who listen to Catholic radio because they're looking for something that's going to edify their souls. They're searching for truth, and they're not finding it in sports radio or political talk radio. They're finding it with Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I read ahead. Exciting questions to come. Let's see how many we can get to with Jimmy before we have to end this hour. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. This one comes from Jamie James, and Jamie asks, is there a scientific reason behind automatic writing? What might be happening outside of supernatural causes and assuming no mental health issues as well?
Okay, so notice the two stipulations. We're assuming that no mental health issues are involved, and we're assuming that nothing supernatural is going on. Now, for folks who may not be aware, automatic writing is a way of generating text, so it involves writing, that a person does not appear to be consciously in control of. That's why it's called automatic. A classical way of doing automatic writing is you take a pen or pencil and you hold it in your hand and you put it down, maybe your non-dominant hand. So if you're a right-handed person, you might put it in your left hand. And then you put it to a piece of paper and you let it start writing without you consciously dictating what it's going to do. And you may even ask questions of it. And it's been proposed that through automatic writing, one may contact, you know, like spirits and get information from them. Interestingly, back in the early 20th century, it's now the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, but then it was the Holy Office. The Holy Office actually addressed the subject of automatic writing, and they gave a very interesting answer. Now, when they got what's called a dubium, which means a doubt or a question, and these are typically sent in by bishops. And when they respond to a dubium, the normal way they do it is they'll say, the bishop will ask a question, and then they'll either say affirmative, meaning yes, or negative, meaning no. Yes, you can do this. No, you can't do this. If they say anything else, it's interesting, because it's not just a straight yes or no. So what happened was this bishop, this is the early 20th century, this bishop sends in an inquiry, and he describes a Catholic who's doing automatic write-in. And he gives him a fake name, Titius. And he says, so here's what happens. Titius, when he learns about someone dying, he wants to find out, you know, like, is this person okay and things like that. And he excludes all negative purpose from his intention. And he prays to God, and he takes a pen and he starts doing automatic write-in, but he has prayed to God. He's excluding all from his intention, all evil influences, all even will. He's trusting God, and the answers he gets back to the questions he asks are all in accordance with the Christian faith. They don't contradict any doctrine at all, and they're typically notes from the departed about like how my relatives are not praying for me enough, or they haven't had masses said for me enough, and I want them to do more of that so that I can move on and get with God quicker and be done with my purgatory. And so everything here is looks on the up and up. He's excluding all evil influences. He's praying to God. He's entrusting himself to God. He's getting Orthodox messages back of the type you would expect from souls that are in purgatory. Is what Titius is doing okay? And instead of saying yes or no, the Holy Office came back and said, not under the circumstances described. So not under the circumstances described is not a flat no, and it suggests there could be circumstances where what Titius is doing is warranted. It doesn't spell out what those circumstances would be. You know, like maybe if a ghost had contacted Titius or something and he wants to get more information, maybe then it would be okay. But it's not a flat no to all automatic write-in. And this is early 20th century Holy Office stuff. This is not some post-Vatican II loopiness. No, this is hardcore, you know, Thomism is large and in charge time. So anyway, that's something to be aware of when you're thinking about automatic write-in. Now, to Jamie James's question, if we're assuming that we're eliminating mental health, you know, problems from the consideration, and we're assuming no supernatural causes, it's not God moving your pen, what scientifically could explain automatic write-in? Well, the pioneering work on this was done by a scientist named Frederick Myers. He lived in the 1800s. He was born in 1843, died in 1901. And he was one of the founders of the British Society for Psychical Research, or SPR. If you go to the Psy Encyclopedia website that they maintain, there's a whole page on Frederick Myers, and it talks about what I'm about to mention. He's well known for having written a book. It actually came out 2 years after his death in 1903. It's called Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death. And as a scientist, Frederick Myers tried to think of all the explanations he could for what might cause automatic write-in. And he came up with five explanations. The first one is conscious will. Now, this could be cases where automatic writing is being consciously willed by a person as a fraud. On the other hand, it might not be intentional fraud. They might still be controlling the pen consciously, but kind of fooling themselves into thinking they're not. Mm-hmm. And so that would be, but it's still under conscious control. the second explanation that Myers proposed was what was referred to as unconscious cerebration. Basically, that it's a fancy term. It just means your subconscious is doing it. So you're not consciously controlling what the pen does, but your subconscious is controlling what the pen does. His third explanation was it could be a higher faculty in your own mind that you're not normally aware of. So it's not your conscious mind. It's something that's part of you, but it's higher than your conscious mind. What that might be, who knows? But at least he's trying to map out the conceptual space of what could be responsible. If it's not your conscious mind, maybe it's something below your conscious mind, like your subconscious. Or if it's not your conscious mind, maybe it's something above your conscious mind, like a higher faculty that you have. Then, so that kind of eliminates all the elements of you. If it's not your conscious mind or below your conscious mind or above your conscious mind, okay, you're not responsible. So what else might be responsible? His fourth explanation was telepathic contact with other incarnate minds. So maybe I'm not in control of what the pen is doing, but I'm in contact with you, Cy Kellett, and it's you who are responsible for what the pen is doing. Maybe it's your subconscious. I'm picking up information, like let's say you're asking me answers to questions that I don't know the answers to, but you know what the answers are. Okay. So let's say you're quizzing me on what did I have for dinner the last 7 nights. Well, I have no idea, but you may know what you had for dinner the last 7 nights. And so I'm writing, and my subconscious is in telepathic communication with your subconscious, and it's pulling that information out of your subconscious, and I'm writing it down.
Okay.
So I'm picking up the info from you. This is a classic problem in parapsychology, by the way, when it comes to like ghosts. And how do you know you're talking to a ghost as opposed to just someone subconscious and you're picking up the information telepathically? Then the fifth and final explanation that Myers proposed was discarnate spirits, meaning humans that no longer have their bodies, and extrahuman intelligences, meaning things like angels that never had bodies or demons that never had bodies. So Myers has these five possible explanations: conscious will, your unconscious cerebration, or basically your unconscious, some higher faculty in you, telepathic contact with other living people, and contact with spirits that are not those of living people. And Myers would, being a scientist, he would only propose the latter, in the last one, of other spirits in rare cases where other explanations did not work. So, Jamie James, that's a sketch of some work that's been done on automatic writing and what might explain it scientifically. And if you'd like more information, check out Frederick Myers' book, Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death, and also the Psi Encyclopedia webpage on Frederick Myers.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm going to get Wayward Templar's question in now. Wayward Templar 1314, where would the Pope go if Rome was nuked with a nuclear bomb designed for maximal radiation damage over the area? The Vatican is largely intact, but is rendered unlivable for millennia due to fallout. Would the church make a new St. Peter's Basilica? Would the bones of the martyrs in the city of Rome be relocated if the area around the reliquaries is too radioactive to enter?
Okay, so we got a series of questions. Where would the Pope go if Rome was nuked? Somewhere else. where that would be, I don't know. It'd be up to him. You know, he might go somewhere else in Italy. He might go further afield. Under the specifications of the question, the Vatican is intact but is rendered unlivable for millennia. Okay, so I'm guessing they were using a thorium isotope in that case. In any event, if it were unlivable for a short period of time, even a century or two, they might not abandon Rome. They might, you know, wait a century and then have a grand Vatican return reopening ceremony. But if it's going to be millennia, my guess is, yeah, they would permanently relocate elsewhere. They've done that kind of thing on a temporary basis before, like during the Avignon papacy, where even though the Pope was the Bishop of Rome, he was functionally living and had his court in France. And so if Rome got taken out by some kind of long isotoped nuke and you couldn't use it for millennia, yeah, they'd build a new headquarters elsewhere. In terms of would the bones of the martyrs in the city of Rome be relocated? Possibly. That would depend on the nature of the isotope and how safe it was to go into Rome and recover sacred artifacts like relics and artworks and other things. But to the extent they could recover those, they would want to.
Wayward Templar 1314, thank you very much for the question. Thanks to everybody who sends these excellent questions to make these excellent programs with Jimmy Akin. You check out Jimmy's work at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts. Check out all the mysteries he covers in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Thanks, Jimmy. I always enjoy these.
My pleasure.
All right. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.